Ouch. There's that hand.
All right, yeah. Go for it.
I think everybody's covered. And so last time we left off in talking about some practical and pastoral concerns. And this, I want to talk about these for a few minutes just to think about how you respond in some practical situations. And I think if you haven't been faced with this, you probably will be. And so if you think about this question, how would you answer? If you hold to the historic Christian view, should you, like what's being said when you attend a wedding of same-sex couple? Is that something you think you would find morally problematic, that you think is morally okay? And why or why not? And then I'm thinking, if you want to push that a little bit further, would you be willing to stand up in the wedding party? In a context like that. And, we can think about different levels of involvement. So I'm thinking here about people you actually know. And then some of these questions have to do with, so let's say maybe it's not somebody that you know, but if you're a Christian baker, right, this has become a point of controversy. Would you bake a cake for a wedding of a same-sex couple? Or even thinking about different ways that you're involved in the wedding. So I was listening to a podcast recently where they were saying, even thinking about the difference between a Christian baker who might bake a cake versus somebody who's sharing the story of somebody who is a wedding photographer. And so part of what they do in terms of taking pictures is they ask people, obviously, to assume certain poses of physical touch and contact. And so saying, would that be different than being a baker? Or how do you kind of navigate some of these practical questions?
So, is that a hand, or you're just perpetually?
And stop again.
No. So I tried to ask this last class, but we just ran out of time. Mm-hmm. Is there any statistic that says any kind of successful gay marriage, like lifelong gay marriage? Because as far as I know, well, gay marriage has not been a long thing in America. And if that's the case, most of gay couples has been just like some sort of a
cohabitation or
something like that.
Yeah.
And from what I understand is that when marriage provides context of harder for someone to get divorced, cohabitation may provide an easier environment for people to get divorced. So I'm just wondering if any kind of, if there's any kind of statistic that says, oh yeah, actually permitting gay marriage helps, gay couples to be more faithful and things like that. So do you know,
if
there's any
statistics
about
that? And I'm sure there's got to be some statistics out there, at least from countries who are kind of further along the path, who've allowed same-sex couples to marry, but I don't know. But that's a good, that's a good question, because more just in the sense of understanding practically, what the implications are. Yeah, good talk to you, Danny.
I feel like I should answer the last question about Christian bakers.
Yeah.
Because my parents own a bakery, and they are Christians, but it depends on people's definitions of how that whole thing works. But my dad actually spoke to pastors about this, because a lot of pastors got very upset when my parents decided that they would cater the Women's Festival, the Michigan Women's Festival, which is a huge festival where everyone who attends is either transgender or lesbian otherwise. And we cater the entire thing, our bakery. We also have made cakes for gay weddings, and we've lost customers because of it, but it's a choice my parents made. I don't think they would want to be legally obligated, but our bakery, because we've chosen to do it, has received some pushback. Also, non-church facilities legally obligated. We are hosting a gay wedding this summer in our bakery, because we're one of the only bakeries that will bake a wedding cake for these women. Hmm. And a church that is directly next door to us is not happy about it. So there's a lot of tension there. Hmm. But, so I don't know. I felt like I should say something just because
yeah.
of acres.
Because you have direct, you're having to wrestle directly with
yeah.
this kind of question. And this, I think, is part of that question is what is said or what is being implied or what does it mean to live in a pluralistic secular culture where, you know, so to say that you do this, I mean, this is where sometimes I start with this question. If a Christian were to say, no, we're not going to do that, well, then would you not do that if it was a wedding where you have a believer marrying a non-believer? And say, well, that's not biblical, like that doesn't line up with biblical views of marriage. You know, or just maybe you look at two people who are or are not Christians and say, yeah, that's a really bad decision just to do that. right? Like I don't condone this wedding just because this doesn't look like a good thing. Like it does. And so once you start in a pluralistic free market system along this path, it's one thing to say, well, I have issues. I would not myself approve of a same-sex couple being married. But it's another thing to say, well, is that what you're doing when you provide a good or service in this context? And if you're going to do that in one case, you better be consistent. Again, this is where I think the charge of hypocrisy can often be leveled at Christians, because it looks like you are singling out
yeah.
a group when there's all kinds of people who are getting married in, you know, what we might say are for unbiblical reasons or unbiblical grounds. Several hands. I don't know who's first. Maybe Silas, then Damaris,
yeah.
Derek, Ben. Okay, I don't know.
Yeah, as
far as the, all right, we'll work through these. Go ahead.
As far as the first one, attending, you know, gay or lesbian wedding. I mean, I thought a lot about this, and as you know, I will too, as a traditionalist view. If the couple were professing Christians, and they were, you know, even if they were professing Christians around the revisionist view, I would not attend the wedding. I'd say, you know, I believe that this is biblically wrong. That if they were both non-believers, it would depend on the context, but I wouldn't draw a hard line there. I mean, as far as being able to relationally reach out to the culture, it's something that's very important, you know, like, even though I don't necessarily support the wedding
yeah.
or the marriage per se, you know, but if they're not believers, it's not my place to cast judgment on what they're doing as non-believers.
Yeah.
So I would not for a believing, for either one or both for professing Christians, but I might if they were non-believers.
Yeah, and that's interesting. What you said reminded me of, I think, Paul's model in 1 Corinthians 5, which is very interesting, because I think a lot of times Christians have flipped this around. So in 1 Corinthians 5:9, Paul says, I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people, not at all meaning the people of this world who are immoral or the greedy and swindlers or idolaters. In that case, you would have to leave the world. But now I'm writing to you that you must not associate with anyone who claims to be a brother or sister, but is sexually immoral or greedy, an idolater or slanderer, a drunkard or swindler. Do not even eat with such people. What business, and this I think is an interesting question, what business is it of mine to judge those outside the church? Are you not to judge those inside? God will judge those outside. Expel the wicked person among you. So I think his strategy there is interesting, because he kind of says if you're talking about people outside the church, right, why wouldn't you expect to associate with people? The difficulty is when people claim the name of Christ but are in a situation where their life looks less than disciplined. Whereas I think a lot of Christians flip this around and say, we're going to overlook the sin that's in the lives of people within the church to some extent, and say we're not, you know, especially sins like greed or slander, right? That kind of don't fit in. But we're really going to judge people outside the church, and that doesn't. I mean, it seems that they've totally flipped Paul's strategy there. So good, yeah, 1 Corinthians 5, I think, is helpful there. Other, yeah, Damaris?
I'm going to talk about the first one, too. A couple years ago, I found out that my best friend from back home was a lesbian. And she was in a pretty serious relationship with this girl, and she talked to me about this because we talked about being in each other's weddings since we were little. Mm-hmm. And so she talked to me about this. She said, I understand if you don't. We had a really good talk, and she would have had no one there. Her parents wouldn't have come. Her sister may not have come.
And so as her friend, I put the value I have in her and the love I have for her above the fact that she that I told her that I would still stand up for her at the wedding. Because being able, and she wouldn't have had any, not, and I made it clear that I didn't support her decision, but that I would still, I loved her enough to, like, I loved her more than the choices that she was going to make.
Yeah.
So she was, I was very clear with what I, she knew where I stood, but she still asked me, and I told her that I would.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but it was hard, because I'm like, how, what, what do I do?
Yeah.
And like, how do I support her, but have her still know that I don't support her choices?
Yeah. Well, and part of what I appreciate about that example is you are looking contextually at a situation where it sounds like somebody is feeling abandoned or alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's different from looking at a situation where maybe people have plenty of family and friend support. And so, like you're saying, you're weighing a number of different things at once. And so to answer this, yeah, it's not just a simplistic, even of saying, does that mean support or not? Well, what are you looking at in the situation? Does some of those concerns come to the forefront as well? But who else? Ben, did you want to chime in now?
No, I was just going to ask, like, does that, like, weigh into it, like, if she has family going or not? Like,
yeah.
Like, would you not go if her family was going, but since her family's not going to be there, you'd be like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that, like, a factor?
Yeah. I don't know. Could
be.
I don't
know. I would have still gone if her family would have wanted.
Yeah.
I would have still been there.
Yeah. And so part of that, too, it sounds like personal relationships.
Yeah.
You know, you're not talking about somebody who you was kind of a random acquaintance.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes a difference, too. Joseph?
I didn't think about further what I was thinking.
Think about this more.
I just, I want to say.
Can I, well.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, you got it.
Okay, that's a subs question again.
Okay.
Seeing as, there's no statistics as far as I know either, because it's relatively new thing, but we can assume that such a relationship, if not based on God, would have relatively the same success rate as any heterosexual marriage.
So.
But we can also add to the factor that I think they would experience a lot more stress from the social world around them, which means they probably more strains on the marriage, which could potentially lead to higher divorce rate.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is, I mean, that would be something interesting to consider. So if we think about the fact that marriages aren't just self-sustaining but rely upon communal support, but this is where I think it could be, I'd just be interested to know if, you know, what if the LGBT community was a better support community for marriages than the church?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That it could be, it could actually be that, so that would be something I would be interested to kind of track, that maybe there would be the sense of recognizing that there is, you know, that this is not, it's a position that is becoming more socially acceptable, but there's still a lot of combat about, around it in the broader culture. And so people would be more actively supportive of it. You know, which makes me think this is part of why we need to talk about Christian marriage as not just what everybody thinks marriage is, but it's right, it is this position that is not typical when we think about articulating what it is. Derek and then John.
I'm gonna jump down to the third question. Should like talking about the legality of businesses and whether they should be obligated or whether they are obligated. You know, according to the law, we're, you know, we're not supposed to discriminate against anyone, and you really only have the right to not serve someone if they're being disruptive or something in that sense. So if you look at it from the law and the law standpoint, when a Christian baker doesn't serve a homosexual couple for their wedding and they get sued or whatever the case that follows, what they look at are the documentation of the business. all the documentation put together, they look at how strongly are they against gay marriage. Is this something that just came up recently? Is this something that they have throughout their entire business life been set on, we're not going to serve these people because we disagree with their lifestyle, and because we disagree because it goes against our convictions as Christians. Because that's the only way that the law is going to accept that it's a true conviction that you have. Which I think is interesting that the law acknowledges that, but we often kind of gloss over that. And I understand that this is a relatively new issue because it has just been allowed according to law to be illegal for homosexual couples across the nation to now get married. But that's not what they're looking at. They're looking at what are your principles, what drives your business. Is it these Christian values? Because if it is, then you're gonna be, then if you're a good business person, you're gonna state that your Christianity drives your business and you're not gonna serve to people. And kind of like you said, differentiating between the marriage of the world and a Christian marriage. Because if you're gonna serve for Christian marriages, then you have to explain that. You can't just say, oh, we're not serving homosexuals, because
then it just appears to be discrimination in that sense.
And it really is.
Yeah.
Because if you're gonna say we're not gonna serve homosexuals, but we're gonna allow non-Christian couples, or one Christian, one non-Christian, or we're going to allow certain other things, we're gonna do weddings for them, or we're gonna but then you don't allow homosexuals, that's discriminatory, and it even more so broadens the idea of hypocrisy around Christians.
Yeah, and so this is, for me, I think this is a really tricky question around religious freedom, because this is something that I think we do have to be engaged in and think about politically, that has always been important, at least in this country, is to say, we affirm religious freedom, such that you can have, for example, historic peace churches like Quakers who would object to fighting in wars, who would say, we believe that our religious convictions call us to be pacifists, to be nonviolent. And so they've received exemptions from the government who say, okay, we're not going to prosecute you for avoiding the draft because you have a religious exemption to this. Like, this is something that you legitimately hold to and believe. It's something that even, some fairly recent cases have had to do with certain Muslim prisoners in prisons where they would say you have to remain clean shaven. Well, for religious reasons, they believe that they should grow a beard. So what do you do in that situation? And in that context, the ruling has come down. It's okay to allow them to do that. That's part of their religious beliefs. But obviously, we recognize there are limits to this as well. This is where it gets tricky, and you have to work through it on a case by case basis. You know, one example of a non tricky example, I guess, would be if somebody said, well, according to my religious beliefs, we have to do a human sacrifice every full moon, and so that's just our religious belief. That the state would step in and say, okay, that we're not going to allow you to do that. But it's a question of how do you chart this out. And I think one of the big problems is because Christians have been discriminatory in the past, that now when we are talking about what I think in some cases are legitimate questions of religious freedom, that's just seen as discrimination. And so you have this, I just saw this on the news the other day that in the state of Georgia, there are these there's a religious freedom act there before the governor, and this has been a controversy in different states. And Disney and some other corporations have said, if the governor signs that into legislation, we're not going to do any movie production there, or we're going to take our business completely out of that state. And I think this is where it's so difficult, because I think if there is real discrimination, that's a problem. but that we also do have to allow for religious freedom.
You know, so this is, so when I say non-church facilities, I'm thinking of, you know, should Kuiper College be legally obligated to host a wedding of a same-sex couple in our chapel? Right, we host weddings here from off campus, you know, people all the time. People go through the process, they pay to do this, to use our facilities. So how should we think about that? Because I think, you know, historically Kuiper College grows out of churches and denominations that would say, you know, they hold to the historic Christian view here about marriage. And so should we be legally obligated to say, well, we're not a church, so we should have to host this, right? It's a different moral question to say maybe should we or should we not? What how should we think about that? But it's a different question to say you're legally obligated to do that, and if you don't, you're going to suffer the consequences of the law.
Yeah. And also another question to consider is the government willing to make, you know, if this is enacted, for example, non-church facilities being legally obligated to host gay weddings, will it go both ways, for example, in that, you know, other facilities would be legally obligated to, you know, host events of beliefs that really conflict with, you know, their businesses' values?
Yeah.
A couple of months back, I don't know if any of you guys know Brian Anderson, this guy with social policy and stuff, and he was part of a traditional marriage, like, kind of event. It wasn't even explicitly religious, just from a political standpoint. And they had it at I forgot what hotel, but eventually the hotel found out, you know, what they were about. And so they canceled, you know, their reservation, and ultimately they were without a venue to host their event. And so, that, you know, it's an important question I think we can ask is, will it go both ways if, you know, such a law is enacted? Will we be able to host events or, you know, whatever?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. It's a fair question. And I think part of what makes all this more difficult is it seems like our culture more and more is, like, we're unable to listen to people with whom we have radical disagreements and even have conversations and even say, well, even on some college campuses where you have commencement speakers who are uninvited because of whatever their political stance is, how do we do that? And so this is where, again, our past oftentimes doesn't help us as Christians, but we can still, going forward in the future, say, how can we actually create a space for civil discourse and interact with people with whom we maybe have really deep, deep disagreements? Joseph, did you want to chime in here?
No?
All right. So, all right, one slide. Next slide. Those are some questions. I want to just make a few remarks. This is on actually on a reading from last time. Think about this and then maybe get around to the PowerPoint for today and some of our discussions around celibacy and heterosexuality. So one of the questions that Shaw raises, which I think is a helpful question, a helpful point, is that many times in our culture and society, we want to see men and women as simply interchangeable. And this is where this goes back to some of our discussion on male and female, gender roles, that to try to walk this balance that I think you have to walk of saying, here are certain ways in which men and women are the same, here are certain ways in which they are different. And I think Shaw points out that at least for some, being an egalitarian can be a slippery slope that leads you to affirming same-sex sexual activity. If your argument for egalitarian is that there's really no difference between men and women, right? And so this is the move that some people have made, even around the discussion of women in church office, to say, well, there's really no difference between men and women, and so it doesn't really matter. And this, I think, then puts you on this path that Shaw says there could be a worry here. Now, I don't think it necessarily does. I think you can certainly affirm that men and women are equal, that there are many respects in which they are the same, but that we still want to, at least I would still want to affirm, that there are some basic difference between male and female without, again, getting overly specific when we start trying to make universal statements about that. We can easily get into some trouble. But I think he's right to note this. One of the things then that we have to reckon with, I've said this before in here, But the modern world, modernity, in many ways, hates bodies because bodies imply limits. Bodies imply that, you know, we are, in many ways, restrained or constrained by how our bodies are and how they work and how they function. And this is part of I think, the view that this difference between men and women is essential, has to do with bodies, has to do even with thinking about that our bodies teach us, the difference between male and female bodies point to something, Christ and the church, that they're meant for something that includes sexual union, but that also includes the reality of children and family. And so in some ways, part of what we are saying is that the limits of your body teaches you something about appropriate action. And in a world that hates limits, that in many ways hates bodies, you know, we want freedom. That's what we want. And so we don't even want our bodies themselves to define or tell us what we are or what we should do or maybe what we shouldn't do. And this is where Shaw brings us back to, in some ways he mentions both baptism and the Lord's Supper, and thinking about the fact that these elements, right, the elements that we use here are actually significant. Get it? Right? That's what I learned. Yeah. And so this is why, I think I mentioned this in here before, right? This is why you can't baptize people with beer. Fun as that sounds, but that was Rex and ruled on in church history, that you can't baptize somebody with beer because the elements are actually significant. Right? This is why when we think about water as pointing to the cleansing and the washing away of sin, that's why you go with water instead of beer. Although I guess you could make the case, no, you couldn't. Drunk with the Holy Spirit?
No.
Probably not, yeah.
Without going to a rabbit trail, then, should that mean that all our churches, we should serve wine instead of grape juice for the Lord's Supper?
I think so, and, well, I think... I was reading somebody about this, somebody on this recently. Was it in Shaw? I don't know if it was in Shaw. Who was I reading? Anyway, they were talking about how the fact that when they did partake in communion, even as a younger kid in a church where there was wine, where, you know, even for them, when they first took that drink of wine, it was like they felt it all through their body. Like, it had this effect on them in a way that Welch's grape juice doesn't. And so it was interesting because it just made me think, you know, the fact that there is this, or there could be that kind of effect, you know, there's maybe something going on there that we should think about more. Especially in, you know, some churches... still may have, you know, just be anti-alcohol as a whole. In my experience, I think most churches don't have a problem with alcohol per se. And if an individual does, you know, this is why you kind of organize, all right, if it's on the outer ring of your little communion cups, outer ring is, you know, grape juice and inner ring is the wine or something like that if people have an objection. But now, you know, so part of the point here is that then when we think about bodies, right, there actually is something important to the physical bodies and what's being said in and through sexual union. So think back to our discussion of theology of the body. You can't just swap out a male and female body for two male bodies or two female bodies and have it say the same thing because there's something said in and through the very physicality of our bodies and what that means. Yes? You're reacting. I didn't see him.
I'm the baptism and beer idea.
Okay.
So, We can't baptize the baby. At what point does it become baby? Or drinks that are water-based, just in general. I mean, okay, so pop has a significant amount of water. Significant amount of sugar, too, you can argue. But so is the point that we can't, where does it turn over and become pop in that point? And rather, like, okay, so say we do explode.
When you
have
like 18
water,
tables with your Mountain Dew.
Yeah, two tables, but like, where does the limit go? I mean, there's dust falling into the water over there. And it makes us up with bile acids too, or not. So where do I... Just technically, it doesn't seem...
Well, this is where, you know, this is where I think... You don't want to be overly technical about it. I think, you know, if you've got water or beer sitting here, you're going to be able to tell the difference. And so...
Well, it's just a cultural construct to call this beer and just say that's something else.
It's just
you're 70% water. Well,
you're thinking it, you're overthinking it.
No, I'm not thinking it's your problem.
But here's what I mean. We also when you look at the Christian tradition, you know, normally this is the case too. So hypothetically, if somebody's on their deathbed and they want to be baptized, and you're far removed, you're out in the desert. Okay, this is why I'm saying normal. Like, they're very extreme circumstances, and all you have is a keg of beer. why you have that in the desert? but the point is that this is so. There are these extreme exceptions because of circumstances, but normally this is seen to be the case. There was even, you know, in the early martyrs, there's some discussion about this, especially people who basically convert and say they're going to follow Jesus, and then they're killed almost instantly. The idea is that they were actually baptized in their own blood. But part of what's interesting is they thought you had to be baptized, though. That's why they tried to think about it. Well, you can't be... Anyway, so they had a very high view of baptism. But this is, even in... Paul's language in Romans 1, which we'll look at a little bit next couple class periods. The idea here is that he says, when we think about who we are as humanity, that there's this difference between God and creatures. And so we are obviously here. We're on the scale of creatures. But we have exchanged proper worship of God, difference, for sameness. And this is part of the language that he uses, and when he says, when he talks about same-sex sexual activity, is that it exchanges this proper difference for sameness, and maps these onto each other. And so the point of difference, I think, is crucial. One other question that I think back when we talked about contraception, I think Sub maybe raised this question. How does contraception factor in here? Because part of the critique, historically, of same-sex sexual activity is it's by nature closed down to the possibility of procreation. And so this is why you go back and you look at different theologians like Luther or Calvin or some of the early church fathers, the way that they talk about it in their minds. There's no difference between the same-sex sexual activity and contraceptive heterosexual activity. So that's, even just today I came across a quote of Luther where he said that use of contraception was worse than incest and adultery. Luther doesn't mince words when he just starts talking about, I don't know, things that are out there. But this, part of the reason I think that this is, I mean, to the historic position up until about 1930, we talked about this again, if you flash back to those classes, or maybe some people are like, no, no flashing back, I've tried to move beyond that. When we think about this, how does it factor in? That a lot of, when you look at the history of interpretation about what Paul's use of the language of unnatural to talk about same-sex relationships is that it's been assumed that against nature or unnatural is any kind of sex that is closed down to the possibility of procreation. So this again is, it's worth thinking about. Yeah.
What's the Roman Catholic's view on same-sex marriage? Because first, out of the light, something just came into my mind, and I feel like one of the Pope actually affirmed it while, you know, humanity, like in his ideology, in his concept, should, you know, reject the practice of it.
Yeah. No, the Roman Catholic Church would reject the idea of same-sex marriage as well.
Okay.
So, and this, you know, part of the discussion even is linguistic. There are different people who say you shouldn't use the word marriage when you're talking about same-sex relationships because marriage does imply certain elements being there, and that includes male and female bodies. But yeah, again, when we're in a culture that uses that terminology, if you're going to be understood, you, I think for the most part, have to just employ that same language. So this is one thing to think about further as we look at this. And I think one of the things that does make it very possible, very plausible, to just move to a place of affirming same-sex sexual activity is the fact that we have so largely accepted contraception with respect to opposite-sex sexual activity. That we've, again, in our culture, we've completely cut that link between sexual activity, sexual union, and children or procreation. So it almost doesn't, it hardly registers as a blip on many people's radar when they think about what's even the point of opposite sex sexual union. That's not really there. The other thing I wanted to mention briefly from the reading last time, and I want to say a couple words here. Happiness is moral authority. This is not, I think this is an area where clearly if you have gay and lesbian folks who are drawing on happiness as moral authority, this is a problem that starts with heterosexual people in our culture. That this is, we're talking about a pattern of thinking, a way of operating that goes back, you know, probably at least 100 years. One very fascinating book along these lines is a book by Barbara Defoe Whitehead called The Divorce Culture. And part of what she points out is, I read this because, you know, after my parents got divorced, you know, the way I'm wired is I don't want to read like self-help books. I want to read a book that talks philosophically about how our culture has got to this point and understand how, like, my parents and even myself are actors in this broader culture that's shaped and molded by this way. And one of the things that's interesting, two different things especially stand out, is that she points out that especially through the 50s and 60s, there's this real shift from focusing on responsibility to personal happiness. And so the goal is for me to sort of realize myself. This I think would fall under the expressive lens of sexuality, if you think about this. And so what's interesting is that people became romantically involved with other people to express themselves. But then when it was time to move on, you know, detaching from those people is a way to express yourself and express your freedom and liberation as an individual. And so you move from a sense of identity through duty, where largely you define yourself and understand yourself by saying, there are these obligations that I have. And those obligations, in part, constrain and define me, right? They, you can't live outside of those. Versus this kind of sense of identity through self-expression. And I think you see this even in, I mean, it's in almost any movie that's, you know, somewhat, any kind of romantically geared movie, identity through self-expression, that a lot of this has to do with, you know, the classic stories of, you know, I'm not listening to my parents, right? I'm not listening to culture and society. We connect with each other. And so we're going to throw off these constraints. And, right? And so usually in our society, those are held up as like these great examples. Whereas think about like Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. What happens when people do that?
They die.
They die. That's it's like you can't. There's this kind of attempt to live beyond this, to live beyond some sense of duty or responsibility or family constraints or social constraints, and it doesn't turn out well. Whereas our culture and society have almost completely flipped those. Right. This is making me think. I know. Have I given a speech in here before in this class about how I hate The Little Mermaid? right? This kind of maps out how we think about The Little Mermaids. In the classic story of The Little Mermaid, there's this desire in some ways to live beyond the constraints of who or what she is. In the classic story, it doesn't go so well. She ends up, right, not being able to do, not being able to complete whatever the whole thing is with the, yeah, whatever. And the end of the story of The Little Mermaid is, like, she's dissolving into sea foam, right? Because she's fallen under the curse of this wish. The whole point is, don't want to be something you're not. Don't try to live, like, you're a mermaid, so be a mermaid, not a human being. Whereas the modern story of The Little Mermaid is, I want to be something other than I am. I'm going to ignore my parents. I'm going to ignore my any kind of constraints or responsibility and friends. I'm going to do this, and then my parents are going to bail me out, and I can do this, and then I'm going to live happily ever after. Like, it's the worst. But that's why, of all the, like, some Disney, whatever, but this one, like, this is the worst. Like, this is the worst. Like, what are we teaching people? But so it's interesting to see how these narratives shift over time. Now, I think this identity through duty and response, this can be constraining. This is not always good. And so the idea is not to say, well, we just need to go back to this previous time in history, but to say, you know, identity through self-expression is why people say, well, you know, it's yeah, I have kids and a wife, but I just need to express myself and really find myself and go beyond that, as opposed to saying, well, I'm not that happy with myself or my wife or maybe even my spouse, but I have a duty here that I need to follow through on. And one of the big things that Whitehead deals with in her book is the myth that, you know, it's better for the kids to have parents who are divorced and kind of happy than parents who are married and not all that happy in their marriage. Her point is, no, pretty much 100% of the time, it's better for the kids to be married or to have both their parents married together in a home that's, you know, maybe their marriage is not that happy, but they're committed to just making it work, even if it's not ideal. And so that I think is interesting. And all this is one area where we do have statistics. Divorce is devastating economically, educationally. It has horrible effects. And the social science research shows this. But our culture, right, tobacco is dangerous. Therefore, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to slap huge taxes on cigarettes. We're going to make it hard. We're going to make it clear to people, this is going to kill you and lead to bad results. But when it comes to divorce, right, the ideology of self-expression is so deep in our culture that we're not saying, wait a second, you just can't divorce for no reason. You have to have some kind of legitimate reason to walk away because of your kids. Right? This is where, when you think about the weakest people in the whole thing, it's children. Does our culture protect them? No.
And some people would even argue that divorce, like no-fault divorce, is even worse than the death of a parent because the separation is a willful one. And it leaves the kid kind of lost in no man's land, where their essential identity is in their family unit, and then when that breaks apart, they're just left in this ambiguous, like, who am I, why am I here kind of thing.
So yeah.
There's no finality to the situation. It's a lifelong endeavor. And some people would kind of argue that divorce is even more detrimental to the kid than the death of the parent.
Yeah. Yeah, is that, somebody's reading an Andrew Root book. Is that you, The Children of Divorce?
Yeah, that's me.
Okay.
Divorce is worse.
And that's, yeah, it is. It's a statement that when you first hear it, you think,
yeah.
What?
Yeah,
but then even when I think about my own experience and think about, you know, my parents' divorce was not an easy one and not one where, like, oh, let's kind of get along and whatever. So it's like you go through this protracted period of years that still continues today. Like, both my relationship with both my parents is still, I mean, that's what shapes our relationship, is this divorce, and you can't get out of that. And so at first I thought, well, that's really weird. And you think, yeah, maybe that would be true. Like, dealing with death would be easier than dealing with divorce. Sarah?
I knew a family that the husband had a lot of problems with substance abuse, and they've been going on for years. So finally they're thinking they're going to get a divorce. They had two kids, so of course that was like really traumatic and everything. And then they're not sure why, but probably related to substance abuse, he passed away before they got a divorce. And in a lot of ways, they were almost relieved because they were clear instead of them.
Hmm.
So I've seen that. It's like,
Yeah.
You don't want to say it's better, but it's better.
Yeah, yeah. An actual scenario where you see that. That's mm-hmm. interesting. Well, there's more we could do here, but I do want to actually get to this next PowerPoint.
Because there are, I do want to try to at least touch on a couple of these things before we shift our discussion somewhat next week to looking at some of the discussions around the biblical text. Today when we look at just a couple of things to look at, the questions, especially around, you know, what do we look for, or what's the proper response to thinking about gay Christians who are struggling with questions of identity or questions of what to do? And this is where I don't know what you thought of it, but I think misstep number 7 in Shaw's book is fascinating to me. Should the church attempt to convert same-sex attracted people to become opposite-sex attracted? This is where I think the church has, for too long, tried to convert people to heterosexuality instead of Jesus. This just struck me. Godliness is heterosexuality. And I just think it's very helpful to say that. I mean, it's very helpful for me even to think about this, you know, the discussion, the story he gives of a father reflecting on this. You know, what I want for my children most is not that they are attracted to the opposite sex, but that they're attracted to Jesus. And that's what pulls them, and that that's what drives them. Now, along these lines, I wanted to pass out an article. I shared this on Facebook a couple days ago, because Facebook should actually be for something instead of just whatever. If it's not for sharing interesting articles
for sharing memes.
And memes, I can appreciate memes.
Passive aggressive. Yes. You know, there's some people who create entire blog posts that are passive aggressive memes about students. it's been done. And this
is a really fascinating read, and I just want to read through this out loud and just hear how you process this.
Will I be gay in the resurrection? He says, as Lent moves rapidly towards its close, I've been trying and mostly failing to make space in my life for some more meditative reading. Right now I'm inching through Francis Young's God's Presence, a contemporary recapitulation of early Christianity. It's a remarkably unclassifiable book as Young weaves her work in patristics, the study of the church fathers, together with personal pastoral reflections largely revolving around her disabled son, Arthur. Today, this passage struck me in an especially forceful way. Arthur's limited experience, limited above all inability to process the world external to himself, is a crucial element in who he is, in his real personhood. An ultimate destiny in which he was suddenly perfected, whatever that might mean, is inconceivable. For he would no longer be Arthur, but some other person. His limited embodied self is what exists, and what will be must be in continuity with that. There will also be discontinuities. The promise of resurrection is the transcendence of our mortal flesh and blood state, so there's hope for transformation of this life's limitations and vulnerabilities, of someone like Arthur receiving greater gifts while truly remaining himself. Perhaps a transformation he hoped for is less intellectual or physical advance, and more the kind of thing anticipated in the present when the fruits of the Spirit are realized in relationships. And so Hill says, not only am I intrinsically interested in what Young says here in disability and resurrection theology, but I also can't help but be struck by how this relates to my situation as a gay, celibate Christian believer. As readers of this blog know, I and others sometimes reach for the metaphor of disability as a way of thinking about our sexual orientations. In my book, Washed and Waiting, I use the metaphor of healing to describe how I thought my sexuality would be transformed when Christ returns. In my chapter on Now, when I wrote, I expect to stand with Henry Nouwen at the resurrection and marvel that neither of us is homosexual anymore. But as time goes on, I feel less sure that that's quite the right way to put it. Certainly those behavioral aspects of my gay experience that are sinful, lust, for example, and pride, won't be true of me at all in the kingdom of God. I don't believe that I will desire sexual intimacy with men in heaven because I believe that that attraction is a result of the fall. And just as certainly, I know I won't be cordoned off from all the rest of the redeemed by any political identity label. I feel confident that gay won't be a descriptor I'll want to hold on to. nor presumably will it be around much longer in this life, well before the end arrives. And yet, as I've said many times here at the Spiritual Friendship blog, being gay feels much bigger and multi-layered and richer than an attraction to bodies. And by the way, let me just interject, this is where I think sometimes Shaw talks about it primarily that way, as though it's just a strictly sexual, physical attraction. But we've talked about how it's, I think, when we think about attraction, attraction is more than that. So it says, being gay feels much bigger and multi-layered and richer than an attraction to bodies, than the sin of lust or the proclivity to identify with an in-group. It's a sensibility. That's the word I keep landing on, and one that somehow seems to pervade my personality, shaping the friendships I form, inclining me to certain kinds of reading, drawing me to specific types of conversations and hobbies and artistic pursuits. Maybe I'm too much a child of my age, letting Freud affect my thinking about the all-pervasiveness of sexuality more than I should, but I still like the way I put it in my spiritual friendship book. He says, quote, in my experience at least, being gay colors everything about me, even though I'm celibate. It's less a separable piece of my experience, like a shelf in my office, distinguishable from the other shelves, and more like the proverbial drop of ink in a glass of water. Not identical with the water, but also not entirely distinct from it either. But if that's true, and if it's also true that Christ's return means I'm to be healed of my homosexuality, then will my entire personality undergo a complete overhaul? To go back to Jung's language above, if I'm to be perfected, meaning if I won't be gay anymore, well, I can't imagine that that wouldn't make me into someone who's almost completely different than the person I am now. And that thought isn't exactly a hopeful one. Jung is right, I think, to stress the discontinuity between our present experience and the resurrection state. I will almost certainly go wrong if I try to imagine too concretely what it will mean to exist with Christ as a resurrected person. I'm mindful here of C.S. Lewis's famous caution about the dangers of trying to imagine the time Jesus predicts when marriage, and presumably also sexual relations, certainly in their current form, will be no more. This is a quote from Lewis. I think our present outlook might be like that of a small boy who, on being told that the sexual act was the highest bodily pleasure, should immediately ask whether you ate chocolates at the same time. On receiving the answer no, he might regard absence of chocolates as the chief characteristics of sexuality. In vain would you tell him that the reason why lovers in their carnal raptures don't bother about chocolates is that they have something better to think of. The boy knows chocolate. He does not know the positive thing that excludes it. We're in the same position. We know the sexual life, but we do not know, except in glimpses, the other thing which in heaven will leave no room for it. So Hill continues, yet I feel, too, that Jung must be right to look for some kind of continuity between her Arthur's disabled life now and his resurrection life in God's future. And I think I'm right, too, to look for, to hope for, some sort of connection between the depth and intensity with which I've been able to love my male friends now and the way I will live in the kingdom of God. Recently, I was emailing about this with a theologian friend of mine, and he said this in reply. Our eschatological healing will not erase the things that have defined us in this life, but will gloriously transform them. So to pick a couple of the classic loci of identity politics, our various ethnic or national identities will somehow survive and add to the richness of the worship in the kingdom. I think I have some biblical support here. And our disabilities will not simply be done away with as if they were never there, but will be transformed in our healing so that an aspect of the glory we display will be as people who were once disabled. Obviously, it isn't hard to fit sexuality somewhere in there, much nearer ethnicity than disability, in my estimation. That in the kingdom, I will be straight, and you and Ale Red will be gay, but these identifiers will no longer name desires, but will instead name facets of the glory of God's grace that will shine forth from our sanctified lives. Surely something like that is true. I want to believe that the way God is shaping my celibate, same-sex friendship, desiring life now will bear some resemblance, however gloriously discontinuous it may be, to the life God gives me when all things have become new. In some way, my disability, if that's the right metaphor for it, will be glorified. What do you think? Yeah.
I think he kind of raises, when he talks about his identity as being gay and forgetting every part of his personality, I guess I flip it around and I think, like, do I think of my sweetness in that way? And I don't know that I do. Like, I don't know if I think that my sexual orientation is like,
yeah.
Like, it just raises that question of, like, is your sexual orientation.
Yeah. Or, well, the question that prompted my mind is it because I'm straight that I don't recognize that? Like, because it is a situation where I'm in the majority, in the same way that, you know, sometimes white people just think, like, well, this is the way it is, and don't realize, like, well, you're white, so, that's why you think it's just, that's the way it is. And so it does, I mean, because I do think, how to flip that around, because I do think that there is a sense in which maybe that it is more all-pervasive than, I mean, maybe one way to think about it is if you were gay instead of straight, how much would that be something you were aware of? Right? I think it'd be, would it be like kind of on your radar like 10% of the time, or would it be, I think it would be there a lot more. And so maybe it's just that it's not on our radar because we're in the majority. So that would be one way I would think about it. Yeah.
I love what I read here, and I think I agree with them, most of it. But one thing that really stops me, or one thing that really makes me confused, is that the way I understand about eschatology is bringing everything back into the place where it was meant to be, restoring everything to what it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
If that is the case, we understand that human sexuality was meant to be heterosexuality. If that's the case, then when the new thing comes, shouldn't all homosexual be restored to heterosexuality again? I think, just the understanding of eschatology where it brings everything, restoring everything, kind of stops me from, agreeing with his view.
Yeah, and that's where, I appreciate the idea of that in the end you have in some sense creation regained, but I think even the discussion here on disability I think is helpful to say it's not as though this didn't happen though, and it's not as though, so it's the world that is in some sense perfected, but only by walking through what we've done, not by kind of erasing what's done. And so maybe another theologian to bring into this discussion is Miroslav Volf, who has done a lot of reflection on reconciliation between different ethnicities and people groups, coming out of some of the tragedies in Serbia and other places in the 1990s, where you have different ethnic cleansing, saying, what does reconciliation look like in the new creation? Does it, because this is the, does it mean you just forget? Or does it mean that there's a way of remembering that is healed? That there are these people who are estranged from each other and maybe who did horrible things to each other, that their restoration doesn't mean simply the negation of that broken past. And that's tricky.
I wonder how much sexuality is going to have a role in heaven. Is it, we know there's going to be no marriage, and we're staying from God, glorify Him all day long. So I don't know how much of attraction we're going to be worried about.
Yeah. But I think there's a sense of, that I think this partly gets at what Lewis says, where it's like, you're not going to have people standing around in heaven being like, man, why can't we have sex? Right? Just like somebody who, like he's saying, somebody who's having sex is hopefully not like, I'd really rather be here. I'd rather be eating some chocolate right now. Or something like that. Well, one would hope. But I think really there the question is more of identity when you think about, is that really me? Right? So when you think about resurrection, there's a sense of continuity and discontinuity. That there's a sense, we're coming up on Easter, you have the glorified body of Jesus, that where there does seem to be some real discontinuity. So it's not just like it's a dead body that was resuscitated, but it's this new glorified resurrection body, but yet it's still him. And it's still him bearing the scars. And so there are, you know, there are these things. I mean, when he talks about disability, I think about, you know, my grandfather who had hemophilia, so his blood didn't clot like it was supposed to. And so he, you know, by the time he was in his 40s and 50s, is just incredibly crippled by this. But yet, to think about who he is, I can't think about him and his life and his walk and his faith apart from this disability. Like, you can't, like, that's who he is. Like, and his walking through that is, in many ways, defining of him. If you say, well, take that away, then he's a different person. So that's, I think, the struggle is to try to think how these are connected.
Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking kind of about that, is that even the language that you use, that Jesus comes to redeem things, and to redeem is to, you know, is to fix the wrongs and to make something new and something better, not necessarily to, I mean, restore things to the way they were, but to redeem them into something new and beautiful.
Yeah.
So, when you know, talking about the disability or the homosexuality, as far as it defines who we are, I like, and even some of the language that he uses in here about how we'll display enough of who we are to glorify the redemption that took place, you know, to glorify God in those things, so that we can, because heaven will tell the story of the redemption of Christ, the things that Christ came to do. It's not like nothing ever happened. It's that Christ is the reason that he is being glorified above all everything else is because he died, because he rose, and because he saved us. That's why we're there.
Yeah.
So there has to be a memory in order for glorification. That's why I think it's more helpful to be redemption than restoration.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that's a helpful way to say it. And even when we think then about our sexuality, this kind of gets us to the next question. Especially in terms of celibacy, I think there's a danger of thinking about celibacy as though it's a non-sexual calling, when in fact celibacy is a calling to use your sexuality in a certain way. That you know, we talked before about theology of the body, the spousal meaning of the body, that the point here is that we're created to give ourselves, and that sexual union is a picture of that, but that in some ways it's the celibate person who takes up the life of the future in the present, who is in some sense called to this now. So it's not that they're living in a non-sexualized way. It's that they're living out a particular calling of their sexuality. Because I think, you know, maybe this gets back to the question Sarah raised, because we are these inevitably sexual beings. And so the question is not whether you're going to be sexual or not, but how you're going to utilize that, or how that's going to manifest itself. So some would say it's impossible in 7 minutes to do these next four slides. But I'm gonna prove them wrong. What I want you to hear is Matthew Vines, who's a prominent spokesperson for affirming same-sex relationships. And we'll read portions of his book, God and the Gay Christian, next time. So he's very articulate, very much on the affirming side of this, but in a way that takes the Bible seriously. He doesn't want to say, we'll just ignore the Bible, but he wants to present a revisionist perspective on saying you can take the Bible seriously, take it as an authority, but still affirm same-sex relationships. But this is what he says about celibacy. And so in these slides, I'm laying out what he's saying. Okay, this is not my perspective on this, but think about how you handle this. He says lifelong celibacy is a gift and a calling, but he also says that, you know, celibacy has to be a choice. It can't be forced. And so this was part of, you know, as he looks at this, he's saying, can you tell people you are called to celibacy? You must pursue celibacy because you are same-sex attracted and there's no legitimate outlet for that. And so here's what he says. He says, trying to maintain the traditional Christian teaching on same-sex relationships as well as traditional teaching on celibacy is not an option. He thinks these two are at odds. I'm not sure that they are, but this is the case he tries to make, because the traditional teaching says it has to be a choice, and he says if you tell somebody you must do this, you must pursue celibacy,
then it's not a choice. So he says celibacy is a gift, and those who do not have the gift should marry. And so he brings a few different scriptures into this. In Matthew 19, this is where Jesus is having this conversation about marriage. And remember, this is where, you know, when he's talking about divorce, and basically saying you should really only get divorced in cases of sexual immorality. And the disciples in verse 10 say, well, if that's the situation, it's better not to marry. Which, again, is always, it's always interesting. But Jesus replied, not everyone can accept this word, but only to those whom it has been given. And so the way that Vines interprets this is that celibacy can be accepted only by those to whom it it has been given, seeing it as this gift that not all have, but some do. He goes to 1 Corinthians 7 then, and this is where Paul essentially says, you know, I'm single. I wish everybody could be single, but I'm realizing, you know, not everybody does. And this is where, now we should note, I'm not sure if this language is helpful. Paul doesn't say the gift of celibacy, but he says, I have a gift and others have other gifts. It's in the context of singleness, but I sometimes wonder if the language of gift of celibacy maybe confuses us a little bit in our culture. But this is what Vine says. He says, for those who have the gift, lifelong celibacy should be possible without causing great damage, but for many gay Christians, that isn't the case. And so he says, if you're really called to celibacy, this is something that's not going to be damaging you spiritually, psychologically, etc. And he gives many examples in the early chapters of gay Christians who just completely struggle with this. And he says, look, this isn't good. This kind of struggle isn't good. And then 1 Timothy 4, verses 1 through 5, Paul here talks about false teachers who forbid people to marry. And he says, okay, it's a false teaching to say people shouldn't get married. He says they actually promote hostility toward God's creation. That's why people say no. They were thinking in this case of male and females, but saying no, you shouldn't get married. And Paul says, well, God's creation is good. And so Vine says a couple of things about mandatory celibacy. He says that mandatory celibacy corrodes gay Christians' capacity for relationship in general by cutting off this possibility. And he says that it requires gay Christians to view all their sexual desires as temptations to sin, causing them to devalue and loathe their bodies. This is woven into who they are. This is woven into their identity. Now, maybe that part of what we've done, I think, the last couple of classes is to say, when we think about attraction is broader than, I would say, than just sexual desires. And so part of what I've been trying to do is say, and I think that even Wesley Hill gets at this a little bit, is to say, are there things that we say yes to in the gay experience? That we would say same-sex sexual activity is wrong, that we recognize the danger of sexual temptation, but even to think about this language of attraction is not necessarily wrong in and of itself, while recognizing that it's extremely complicated. And so Vine says, this last point, if you devalue and loathe your body, this is incompatible with the doctrine of creation, which says God creates all things good. Incarnation, which affirms the goodness and value of creation. And resurrection, which again, he says, this points out the fact that bodies are good, creation is good, the physical matter is good. And so it puts gay Christians in a spot where, because of the way he puts it in terms of sexual desires or physical desires, to say that's just wrong, but that's so deeply woven into them, leads to a bad doctrine of creation. And so this is kind of how he summarizes his discussion. He says, the purpose of celibacy is to affirm the basic goodness of sex and marriage by pointing to the relationship they prefigure, the union of Christ and the church. Mandatory celibacy for gay Christians does not fulfill that purpose. It undermines it. It sends the message to gay Christians that their sexual selves are inherently shameful. It's not a fulfillment of sexuality for gay Christians, but a rejection of it.
1 minute, thoughts, responses.
Yeah, awesome. Sub, was that me?
Yeah.
Okay, Austin, go ahead and say.
And I don't know if this is too simplistic of like a counter argument or just, well, the first thing that came to my mind is like, if it's, you might be arguing if it's hard for you, then you might not have the gift. Like,
yeah.
That was the first thing that came to my mind. It's like, well, what is the discernment if you have that gift? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. It just seems like if it's, if I struggle with it too much and it makes my life harder, then maybe I don't have the gift, and therefore I can succumb to
desires. And that's exactly why I think the language of gift here is maybe problematic. I was thinking about making a flow chart, and this is overly simplistic, but I have a complex theologian in my head. Like, a flow chart, like, do you have the gift of celibacy? You have a flowchart like, are you currently married? Then no, you don't have that. Are you currently unmarried? Congratulations, you have the gift of celibacy, at least until which point you are married. And I think, part of, I think, the problem with this is to say celibacy has to be voluntary. I know a lot of single Christians who are not single by choice.
Right.
And if they could choose, they would go the other way. And so this seems kind of callous toward, the 56-year-old single woman in my church who's always wanting to get married and who never chose this. It's kind of like, well, you're a second-class celibate because you didn't actually voluntarily choose that. Right? Okay. Sorry, we're a minute over. I will see you next time.
Oh, yeah, exams. John.
These are...